our press conference and press luncheon here to release the Advanced Energy Now 2015 market report. We've got a nice crowd here, and looking forward to getting questions about the report, state of the advanced energy industry country. Everyone has got the report in our handouts, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on the data and the details of the report. You've got that material yourself. The point here is to get some context and experience from the companies who are active in the industry. Format is going to be pretty straightforward, as outlined in the program. We're going to get some overview remarks from Graham Richards, the CEO of Advanced Energy Economy. We're going to hear a little bit from our lead researcher at Navigant Research, who will tell us a little bit about the data that goes into this market report every year. And then we're going to hear from a number of representatives from companies who are members of AWE, from across the industry technology spectrum, who can talk about the realities of this growing industry from their perspective. And finally, we're going to hear from one of our state partner organizations. As we all know, energy markets are local and regional, and a lot of energy regulation takes place at the state level. And we at AWE work with the state coalition of now 15 state partner organizations across 25 states to advance the advanced energy industry state by state. And with that, let me tell you for folks on the phone, to get into the question queue, press star 1. We will get to Q&A after we've heard from all of our member companies, and look forward to your questions. And so if you have questions, just press R1 and get in the queue, and we will take you as we can. And now, let me turn it over to Graham Richards, CEO of Advanced Energy Economy.
Mark, thank you very much, and thank you to our guests and our member companies who are here with us in Washington, D.C., for our presentation of information, the press conference around the Advanced Energy Now 2015 market report. We're delighted to have representatives from Navigant Research here as well, who have helped us now complete this report for 4 years, and we thank you for that. Advanced Energy and our organization, our Advanced Energy Economy, is a national business association made up of companies that deliver the technologies, the products, and services that make energy that we use more secure, clean, and affordable. We call that Advanced Energy. Advanced Energy is sort of a new name for a new industry. Back in 2012, as I mentioned, we enlisted Navigant to help us define and to measure the size of the advanced energy industry. We thank them for their work, and we again have an outstanding report to share with you. The Advanced Energy Now 2015 market report, which we are releasing today, is an accounting of the size and the growth of the advanced energy market. This year covers 4 years beginning in 2011. And here are a few top highlights from this report. Advanced energy is a global market of nearly $1.3 trillion. That's as big as the apparel and fashion industry worldwide. It's nearly four times the size of the semiconductor industry. The global advanced energy market grew 12% last year. That's the biggest year-over-year increase we've seen in the 4 years of our tracking this market. The U.S. advanced energy market grew 14% last year. That's five times the growth of the economy overall, and it's up 38% in the past 4 years. In addition, at roughly $200 million in revenue, advanced energy in the United States is bigger than the airline industry, it's equal to the pharmaceutical industry, and almost as big as consumer electronics. As you can see, advanced energy is a major industry in this country. This report shows strong growth in a few areas I'd like to highlight. The wind industry bounced back from a down year of 2013, a full level of pipeline of projects. We saw continued dynamic growth in solar, up 39% this last year, tripling over 4 years, plus a surge in the sales of natural gas turbines, up 48%. And then building efficiency is now our biggest advanced energy segment in the United States, with over $60 billion in technology, products, and services that save energy and save money. The industry growth has been a strong 43% growth over 4 years. In last year's report, we said that the business is good and that policy matters. While we won't talk in detail about policy today, we know that policy helps drive the growth of our markets. We've seen it in federal tax policy that's critical for the tax provisions for advanced energy. And when they have been allowed to lapse, they need to be extended because those help move the market as well. So making energy tax policy stable, predictable, and technology neutral so our industry can invest and grow for the long run is very important. And state policy matters as well. In some states, renewable energy and energy efficiency policies are under attack. In other states, we see an opportunity to do more, especially in the area of energy efficiency and peak demand management. In particular, we're pleased to see states like New York, California, Hawaii, Minnesota, Massachusetts are beginning to rethink the what we call 21st century electricity system, the utility business and regulatory model. We see that these new rules will help maximize the value of distributed energy resources and make the power grid more reliable, more resilient, all at the same time. We've been in the conversations about utility reform all across the country. We're active, obviously, very much so in the New York Reforming the Energy Vision proceeding. Our companies are also engaged and want to see effective implementation of the EPA's Clean Power Plan. This is an historic opportunity to modernize the electric power system for the 21st century. We're also working at the state level. We are active in over 25 states with 15 state and regional partners. We'll hear from one of those partners a little bit later on our presentation. Benefits are economic as well as improving the environment. Today we are focused on the success we are seeing across the advanced energy industry. I'm very pleased to have a number of our leaders, our member companies here, to share their ideas and their thoughts with you about the impact of the advanced energy.
Thank you, Graham. This is our third annual analysis of the advanced energy market globally and in the U.S. Throughout all this time, our colleagues at Navigant Research have been doing the work to quantify the size of this very diverse industry. And all that time, Dexter Gauntlet has been our senior research analyst at Navigant and lead author of our report. So I'd like to ask Dexter to give a little taste of what goes into compiling the data that gives us this report.
Great, thanks, Bob. It's a pleasure to be part of this report for the having the opportunity to look at 4 years of data. One of our favorite things about working on the Advanced Energy Report is the ability to take our entire research library, which is about 90 to 100 reports a year, and just look at it with one time. And with these last 4 years of data, we've seen the U.S. is a significant player in the advanced energy economy. Over the last 4 years, it's represented between 15 and 16% of the global advanced energy market. And what's really interesting, and you'll see in this report, is the trend toward smart energy, toward advanced transportation, advanced buildings, advanced utility innovations. It's the interplay between the traditional power generation verticals along with the smart technology, demand response, electric vehicle charging. And the energy cloud, is rapidly approaching. And it's the connection of all these that really drives the economic growth as well. So we look forward to hearing from some of the representative companies here today.
Thank you, Dexter. Now I want to turn to some of our member companies to talk about what's been going on in their part of the advanced energy industry. I'm going to start with wind energy. That's one of the noteworthy developments in this year's report. 2013 was a very bad year for winds, where there was a real setback due to the lapse of the production tax credit. That extension of that credit with the new commence construction language that allows qualifications for projects that got underway has helped the industry to rebound for 2013 from $2.1 billion to $8.2 billion, but also have a very strong pipeline going into 2015 from that extension. So I'm going to ask Susan Riley from Res Americas to tell you a little bit about wind business.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. So I'm Susan Riley, president of RES Americas, a company that's based in Broomfield, Colorado. RES develops and builds wind farms in the U.S., Canada, and Chile. We've been in the U.S. for 17 years, and we've built about 10% of all of the wind farms that have been built right across the U.S. So a lot of experience. We have seen the up and down and the impact of policy and stop and go over the years, like many other companies in our sector. We employ over 500 people, and that number is increasing. And in 2014, thanks to the PTC extension, we worked on over 1,000 megawatts in the U.S. And some of those projects came online in 2014 and were installed and will be in numbers that are in the National Report. And a fair proportion of that number will complete construction in 2015. So 2015 is also looking like a healthy year for our business and many businesses in our sector. And looking more broadly at the wind industry, in 2014, just under 5 gigawatts was completed, gigawatts of electricity plants. But a couple of years ago, as we just mentioned, we had about 13 gigawatts that were under construction that were built that year. And going into 2015, and at the moment we have about 13 gigawatts under construction, so well over double what we did in 2014. We're expecting to come online in 2015. With the right policy, as Graham mentioned earlier, the future for wind energy will be very positive. We're demonstrating already that wind is making a significant contribution to the U.S. economy. We have 4.4% of all electricity in the U.S. was generated in 2014 from wind energy. The target for the industry is to get to 20% by 2030. And that would mean that on average, between now and 2030, we would build about 10 gigawatts a year. And as you can see from 2012 and what we'll do in 2015, that's a very feasible target. We've built more than 10 gigawatts in the past in 1 year. So we know that that's possible, but it's very dependent on policy, as you heard from Graham earlier. The benefits, just to close, the benefits to the U.S. economy are pretty important, as well as the benefits to the environment. And what we don't hear a lot of, we hear a lot about carbon reduction when we talk about environmental benefits, but wind energy has a very good overlap with water issues across the U.S. And we're hoping to raise the profile of that a little bit more going forward. Utilities are experiencing issues with water shortages, and wind energy is also a solution to that, as well as the carbon reduction. But it's focusing really on the economic benefits. We have many studies that show the economic benefits to customers of production of wind energy in the most productive parts of the country, and we're looking to exploit more of that going forward. And customers are already getting benefit of fixed prices when they deal with wind energy, so they're not exposed to the volatility that you might see from other forms of energy, and that's a major economic benefit. And just finally on the economic benefits, manufacturing across the U.S. is a significant manufacturing base already. We have about 500 facilities in 43 states, so a significant manufacturing base, which we hope to utilize as we build to our 20% target.
Thank you, Susan. One of the consistent trends that we've seen over all the editions of the Advanced Energy Now Market Report is the burgeoning growth of solar PV. This year was no exception, up 39% over 2013, and overall nearly triple the revenue from our base year of 2011. So I'm going to ask Tom Starrs of SunPower Corporation to tell us a little bit about the solar industry.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tom Starrs. I'm the Vice President for Market Strategy and Policy at SunPower Corporation. SunPower is a global solar technology leader and energy services provider, founded 30 years ago in Silicon Valley by a Stanford professor. We're one of the most diversified companies in the solar photovoltaic industry space. We're an upstream manufacturer of the most efficient solar panels available and commercially. We integrate those solar panels into complete solar power systems, and we sell those solar power systems really at every scale, from residential to commercial to industrial to utility-scale power plants. We have over 100,000 residential customers in the United States, and we're a publicly traded company with about $2.6 billion in revenues. Touching on a couple of job-related issues, we have over 6,000 employees worldwide. About a little over 4,000 of those are in our manufacturing facilities in the Philippines and in Malaysia. We have about 1,400 people employed in the United States, mostly in four U.S. states. We also, because of our business model, we serve the residential and commercial market primarily through a dealer network. So we have another 500 SunPower dealers who employ about 6,000 more people across the country. We are also, as I noted, in the utility scale power plant business. We're currently finishing completion of the largest solar photovoltaic power plant in the world, called the Solar Star Project in the Mojave Desert, California. It's a 579 megawatt project, and that project alone employed about 450 people at the peak of construction in an area that's an economically disadvantaged part of California. Looking ahead, we feel the prospects for every part of our business remain very strong, and we're particularly interested in the expansion of our business, again, historically a photovoltaic module, but also a complete photovoltaic systems business, and expanding into these other areas. So we've heard about already the energy cloud, so to speak, looking at integrating our photovoltaic systems with battery storage capabilities, with demand response and other load management capabilities, and creating these complete smart energy systems that allow customers a greater ability to manage their own energy consumption and production, and to do so in a way that benefits not only them, but also the utility grid, by being sort of active participants in a smarter utility system. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Building efficiency has been a driver of advanced energy growth in the United States for all 4 years that we've been tracking the market, and lighting has been one of the strongest performers within the building efficiency segment. With this year's report, we were able to start tracking residential energy efficient lighting as well as commercial energy efficient lighting. And that extra $9.6 billion in residential lighting was enough to make the building segment the largest segment of the advanced energy industry in the U.S. Philips has been a leader in the lighting field for many, many years, and they are a member company of Advanced Energy Economy. So I'm going to turn it over to John Pauling to tell us a little about his part of the industry.
Thank you. Philips has been around 123 years making lights, and obviously, I use that to say we, the sun produces more light than Philips, but we can team with the sun, never given that. Over 100,000 employees globally, over 20,000 in the U.S., LEDs manufactured in San Jose, and factories in Texas, Mississippi. We make the antique light poles in a very unique specialty out of just right up the road outside of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where we are doing a lot of work on the outdoor component. But that's the next wave. Building efficiencies are dramatically improving, and LED indoor lighting has come of age. The efficacy of the LED, the price point, has reached the point where anybody who is considering upgrade, renovating, or designing a new building is going to look to LED to begin with. It's not just an energy issue as well. It's also a maintenance issue. So if you want to replace these lamps, you would like to do that every 10 years and every 10 months. So the opportunities for energy efficiency continue to grow in the building sector, the residential sector, and adding commercial building. There's a lot of opportunities still out there in buildings that are currently leased, and the people who lease the buildings don't necessarily have the same incentives that the owners do some of the retrofits we need. And so that will be a great opportunity for more energy efficiency and more economic opportunity for companies that are in the business of not just making the lighting, but installing the lighting, maintaining the lighting, and as well as other building systems. The outdoor lighting market is huge. There are, depending on whose count, between 45 and 60 million street lights, alley lights, roadway lights in this country owned by various public entities. Very huge, which are LED. That transformation will not only produce significant energy savings, but maintenance cost savings. We struggle to fund the highway bill. It's always good to have opportunities to reduce operating costs at the state level for the highway system. So, and of course, improves the public safety. There's no question that the better light makes for safer driving and greater visibility. So the opportunities to improve the economy, improve job opportunities in this country are very significant still because of the transformation in LED lighting. It will continue in the building space, and it will expand very rapidly in the outdoor space and even garages. Did anybody run in on Wamata today? Park in one of the garages. We're redoing all those garages and cutting energy use well over 65% anymore. We've gone as much as 83% in some garages with retrofitted. So the opportunities are just enormous in this field. So thank you.
Thank you, John. Well, demand side management is not only about hardware, it's also about software. And one of the leading areas in this area is demand response. And the U.S. is the worldwide market in demand response. 2014 accounting for $1.2 billion of the $2 billion worldwide demand response market. One of the leading companies in demand response and other energy efficiency services is Enernoc. And I'm glad to have with us David Brewster to tell us about Enernoc's business.
Great. Thanks, Bob. I'm David Brewster. I'm the president and founder of Enernoc. And Enernoc provides energy intelligence software to both large businesses and institutions as well as utilities around the world. Our enterprise software platform helps large businesses and institutions manage how they buy energy, how they use energy, and when they use energy. And we recently surpassed $1 billion of customer savings through our solutions since our company's inception. Separately, we have a utility software platform that helps utilities engage commercial customers. And through that engagement, improve the customer experience and really increase customer participation in energy efficiency and peak demand management programs, as well as other products and services. Enernoc employs about 1,200 people, mostly in the U.S. We have offices in 12 countries around the world. We're headquartered in Boston, Massachusetts. And last year, we generated approximately $470 million of revenue. 80% of that within the United States, 20% of that from overseas markets. And as Bob mentioned, our sort of killer app, if you will, has been demand response. That's what has fueled our growth to nearly $500 million over the last 10 years. And it has enabled us to acquire 6,300 large commercial and industrial customers that have multiple tens of facilities, each on our platform. And, empowering customers through software and services to actively participate in electricity markets and to sell their operational flexibility in terms of when they consume electricity is a much better solution than building fossil fuel power plants that sit idle 99% of the time. So this is really about engaging customers to be active participants and selling demand-side flexibility into the market. Collectively, our software now manages about 9,000 megawatts of demand response capacity around the world. That's the equivalent of about 90 fossil fuel peaking power plants that have not needed to have been built because of this demand response capacity. Demand response is saving over $10 billion a year to consumers in the U.S. alone. And as you might imagine, with that savings, not everybody likes demand response. It has independent power producers, traditional generators have adamantly fought to destroy demand response, and there's a critically important case at the Supreme Court right now looking at how demand response is going to continue to provide value in our nation's wholesale electricity markets. But DR, demand response, is really just the beginning. And as I mentioned, you know, we sell software to both enterprises and utilities. The fastest segment of our business is selling energy intelligence software to enterprise customers. We expect 70% growth this year in that business to about $75 million. And the driver of that is large businesses needing to get a handle on energy expense management, so needing a software platform to manage energy. They have software platforms to manage human capital and customer relationships and ERP and product and everything else, and sort of the final frontier is energy, providing enterprise-class software to help large businesses and institutions more effectively manage energy, manage those expenses, and be more efficient.
Thank you, David. Energy efficiency is also about what consumers do with their energy. I want to now turn to Richard Caperton to tell us about O-Power and the work that they do with utilities and residential customers to save money.
Thanks, Bob. And Graham, thanks to you and your team for pulling this together and have again for a great product. It's good to be a part of a growing and exciting industry. O-Power is an enterprise software company that provides solutions to electric and gas utilities. We help them improve their customer engagement. Now, what we do is we combine data analytics, behavioral marketing, behavioral science, and customer marketing to generate personalized energy usage insights for each individual customer at a utility. And by giving people the right information at the right time, we're able to achieve reduced energy usage, improved customer satisfaction, and lower cost to serve. 2014 was a good year for O-Power. We had an initial public offering in April. We raised $130 million that we spent on building our software platform and improving our software platform. We signed up some exciting and strategic new clients. We're now working with TEPCO, the largest utility in Japan, China Light and Power, Southern California Edison, among more than 90 other utilities around the world. We have more than 600 employees now, and our revenue grew by 45% last year to $128 million this year across a range of solutions. We also saw some exciting energy results for the first time in several years. People have known about our behavioral energy efficiency tool for several years. This year, we proved that by using normative comparison and behavioral messaging, we can get people to save energy at certain times. Just like InterNOC does demand response, we do a behavioral demand response tool. And at three utilities where we did that with no price and no device, we saw results of 3% reductions in peak hours. So those are exciting. Now, 2015, we're going to see a lot more growth. We're going to see growth in our energy businesses and our energy efficiency and demand response. We're also going to see a lot of growth in improving the customer the customer relationship with utilities. Utilities today spend $30 billion on customer operations. That's things like billing. A lot of that money is negatively spent for the customer. It's not a positive customer experience. And we think that you can improve that customer experience. So we have new tools that a lot of our clients are excited about, like improving the billing experience, letting people know when a bill is coming, letting them know what that bill is going to look like, letting them know if they're on track for a high bill, letting them know why their bill is high and what they can do next time to keep it lower. All of those things will help people save energy. They will reduce the cost to serve, and they will improve customer satisfaction. So we think there's a lot of new business out there. Utilities are facing a number of challenges. Some of those are regulatory challenges. Some of those are competitive challenges, including from AWE members. And some of those are challenges related to the customer perception and customer expectations. They want their experience with their utility to look more like Amazon and Uber than their electric and gas utility, and we think there's a lot that we can do to help them get there.
Great. Thank you, Richard. In addition to all of the revenue data that is is compiled in this market report. We also include 17 this year feature stories on key trends that are shaping the advanced energy markets nationally and worldwide. One of those feature stories in this year's report is on energy storage, an area of advanced energy that that we see and Navigant sees as absolutely ripe for takeoff. So now I want to turn to Karen Butterfield of STEM Incorporated to tell us about energy storage products and services.
Great, thank you. Well, Susan is the big sister, Tom's the big brother, John is the grandfather, 3-year-old grandfather. We're the little sister and the little brother of the clean or advanced energy economy.
I think I was doing great,
right? Great. I was trying to be funny. STEM is has been around for 6 years. We have 60 employees. We're located sort of halfway between San Francisco and Silicon Valley. And our business model is to take a lithium-ion battery, pack it up into a tower about the size of a gym locker, 2x2, 7 feet tall, and then take the meter data from the utility meter, 1 second real-time data, and combine the battery storage and the data that's coming in from the meter to generate savings for the commercial customer. So we're looking at what does the customer pay, what time do they pay it, and then charging and discharging that battery according to that benefit to the customer. Additionally, we make this resource available in an aggregated way to the local utility. We recently were awarded 85 megawatts with Southern California Edison, and we are also working at Hawaiian Electric Company to solve some of the renewable energy grid challenges that they have in Hawaii. So in that situation, we take all of the data from the batteries as a fleet. Some are charged fully, some are charged halfway, some are charged less than halfway, and we have all of the monitoring points on the batteries, and then we can offer that to the utility at a moment in time or an hour in time when they need it. So, you know, it's a pleasure to be here and take any questions when we open it up.
Great. Thank you, Karen. Our market report looks at global markets and the national market in advanced energy, but in many important ways, energy states are themselves energy markets. The rules set by legislation and by state regulatory authorities, particularly in the utility industry, are very important in determining the growth opportunities available to advanced energy companies. That's why we work with a number of state and regional partner organizations who are the local face of the advanced energy industry, representing the companies that are present and growing in those states and have an interest in the market rules and regulations that can allow them to grow and to serve those state markets. Dan Scripps is the head of our state partner in Michigan. And I'm going to ask him to tell a little bit about the work that he is doing there with that state partner organization. Dan?
Thanks, Bob. As Bob mentioned, I lead the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council. Like AEE, we represent companies from across the technology spectrum that is advanced energy. And we also represent manufacturers, project developers, installers, and those companies at the cutting edge of research and development. 2014 was a year of real growth for advanced energy in Michigan, and that's across technologies, across the state from a geographic perspective, and we also saw real growth in both deployment and manufacturing. On the manufacturing side, GM, one of our largest companies in the state, obviously, announced in April that they were investing $450 million to expand operations at two plants connected with the manufacturer of the Chevy Bolt and the batteries that power the Bolt. And that is expected to lead to 1,400 new jobs in electric vehicle manufacturing. In October, they announced an additional $240 million investment And it's not just autos. We had real growth in solar manufacturing in Michigan in 2014, multiple plant openings across the state representing the full solar supply chain. To take one example, Suniva, a company that was spun out of Georgia Tech, announced its first outside of Georgia manufacturing facility just outside of Saginaw, Michigan, working with a local economic development organization, taking advantage of the proximity to Hemlock Semiconductor, the largest manufacturer of polysilicon in the world, and really making use of some of the advantages of locating in Michigan. We're also seeing growth on the wind side, wind tower manufacturer located just outside of the Port of Monroe, bioenergy, really across the manufacturing sector growth in a number of sectors. On the deployment side, 2014 was the best year ever for advanced energy deployment in Michigan. We saw $700 million in investment associated with compliance with the Michigan Renewable Portfolio Standard. That's up from $400 million in 2013, nearly a 2x increase. We saw five new wind farms come online in 2014, totaling 400 megawatts of new nameplate generation. And this totals $2.9 billion in economic impact since the RPS was established in 2008. We saw new digesters come online, an 18% increase in net metering, largely solar. We saw the Lansing Board of Water and Light announce that it had procured 5 megawatts of solar at less than the cost of both new coal and new natural gas. Which surprised, I think, everybody in Michigan. And we also saw breaking ground on the $140 million M1 light rail line in Detroit. On the efficiency side, $1.2 billion in commercial and industrial energy efficiency, saving $500 million annually for ratepayers since 2008. Detroit announced a major LED street lighting project, and the fastest growing company in Michigan of all sectors, not just the energy, not just advanced energy, the fastest growing company in Michigan is an energy management firm located in Traverse City. And there's good prospects for the future, too. We saw major breakthroughs in research and development. A company called FACT3, which is an Ann Arbor-based U of M spin-out, it's a solid-state battery company, published test results that indicate they could, on a fully scalable manufacturing platform, double the energy density of batteries. Really exciting stuff across sectors. All of this comes at a time where there's an active energy policy discussion in Lansing, our state capital. This is the last year, 2015, is the last year of our state's renewable portfolio standard and where we go from here, how we make sure that whatever we do allows us to cost-effectively comply with the Clean Power Plan and take advantage of the opportunities there. And MISO is also projecting a 3-gigawatt capacity shortfall for Lower Michigan, the Lower Peninsula, in 2016. So a number of factors that are all sort of contributing to a very active energy policy discussion. But from our perspective, looking back at 2014 and looking ahead, we feel like we have a great story to tell. There's real momentum in the industry, and we'll approach the policy discussion from a position of real strength. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan, and thanks to all of our speakers. We hear a lot of success and a lot of progress across the technology spectrum of advanced energy and a lot of exciting things going on. I'm going to open the floor to questions from the press. We're going to start with questions from the reporters in the room. But those of you on the phone, if you have questions, get into the queue by pressing star one, and we will take questions after we've heard from folks in the room. Anyone have any questions for any of our speakers? Go ahead.
I'm Julie Piper of Green Tech Media. Elaborate a little bit more on this hot topic in the news, the relationship between utilities and this new emerging market. To what extent are you collaborating with them? Has the dialogue changed? I think it's sort of a little bit cool to say now that you're a utility justifier. Where are we now in this industry and in your relationship with utilities?
Let me start off by indicating that our board of directors asked us 3 years ago to begin a discussion perhaps best summarized by work that we've been engaged in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, Michigan most recently, and Dan can speak to the event that we had in Michigan. Our belief is that by convening and connecting and building a collaboration model, so in New York, for example, in December of 2013, Richard Kaufman and Audrey Zimmelman asked the Advanced Energy Economy Institute to hold a gathering where advanced energy companies, many in the room here, there at that time, with the CEOs of the electric utilities, to discuss the challenge brought on by a number of forces. Most immediate was the resiliency issue from the hurricane. If you rebuild and you build for a stronger grid, a grid that can withstand the challenges of severe weather, what would that look like? And how would we integrate resources that had not been present when the state statutes and the utility regulatory system was put in place? And by that I mean distributed energy resources, embracing a number of the innovative technologies, software systems that we're talking about. Second piece, innovative new finance that's taking place, and technologies that didn't even exist 3 or 4 years ago, and companies that have been growing and developing, in addition to companies like General Electric that was present, and Landis and Gear, Toshiba, a major manufacturer globally of smart meters, and our companies around this table were also present. So that process becomes one where we bring together advanced energy companies working with our state partner, and the first track of that process came out within the last 10 days. And about 60 of the comments could be directly attributable in track one to the work that our advanced energy companies helped to present to encourage a new way of encouraging investment by utilities and getting a, what I would say, a more complete opportunity for grid modernization and for secure, clean, affordable energy. We can get more granular on that. They say that's the process that has then spread to California, where we did a similar event with representatives of the electric utilities and advanced energy companies, trying to find some common ground for moving forward for a 21st century electricity system. That combined with the regulation known as 111D, America's Clean Power Plan, we think are two major drivers for public policy change and for encouraging the growth of advanced energy companies. Happy to turn that question to others who may want to comment on it, but that's the general approach that the advanced energy economy has been taking.
You wanted to highlight a couple of the specific prompts of what are the ways that you would have the utilities and the advanced energy economy businesses work together? Either maybe a couple highlights from that tier one. I thought you were referring to the RIF that came out the other day. Okay. And if you could summarize maybe some of those specific recommendations, that might be helpful.
Richard, do you want to jump in a little bit? Because you've been pretty involved in that.
Sure. I was going to say you should also talk about maybe the utility committee with NAAA as an example of their commitment to this industry. Edison invented the light bulb 135 years ago. We also invented the electric utility 135 years ago. And over those 135 years, utilities have developed a range of expertise, not just in owning and operating wires. They do that. They're very good at that, and they need to do that going forward. But they have also developed a strong customer relationship. They have a strong customer-facing brand, and they understand their customers better than many of that AWE companies could ever understand their customers. I think that we need utilities to be a delivery vehicle for a range of new solutions, and OPower is working in New York to make sure that we work with utilities to deliver behavioral energy efficiency and behavioral demand responses, specific examples. But they are a great way to deliver advanced energy outcomes at scale.
David, do you want to chat about that?
I think Richard just articulated it well, but I think utilities are increasingly being recognized as central to all of this. I mean, I think around this table you heard most of us talk about a component of our business or our entire business, which is working with utilities to help deploy these advanced energy systems. So they're central to this. I think REV is exciting because what REV is all about is creating the platform of the utility that creates a common interface and marketplace, if you will, for innovation to come to market through the utility. So they're trying to remove some of the barriers to integration and getting involved in that utility platform to reach the utility's customer with these solutions. So I think it's partly business model innovation for the utilities. I think a big part of this is policy, though, and, you know, REV is a big part of that. But traditionally, utilities in this country and in many countries around the world get paid by building infrastructure and earning a regulated rate of return on that capital investment and selling electricity. And with our products and services, a lot of this is about reducing the need for capacity or energy sales. And so we need to reform all over the world that regulatory paradigm, so utilities have the incentive and they're not hurt financially by all this innovation that's in societal interest. We want to reduce carbon, we want to reduce energy, and we need to make sure that utilities have a stake in that and are incentivized to do that.
If I can pick up where David left off, I think it is the really intriguing element of what he said. You know, in SunPower's view and our industry's view, there are really great opportunities for utilities to engage more actively with their customers. Their customers are not only consumers of electricity, but increasingly producers of electricity, the so-called prosumers. And I think one of the things that where we see tremendous potential, not just with our technology, but the array of technologies that are represented in the room, is the opportunity for utilities to engage with their customers in a way that actually makes their customers, you know, to use a cliche to some extent, part of the solution rather than part of the problem, which is the way they largely see a lot of what we're doing now. And I think the most obvious thing is that there are, you know, very tangible costs to the utility of operating and maintaining the system that can be substantially reduced if the utilities work with their prosumers to figure out ways to shift demand to actually absorb what might be, I love saying this, the excess of solar energy that, you know, if you look at the Dutch chart in California, for example, that the California utilities, CalISO, are expecting to be on the grid, you know, sort of post-2020. The excess of wind energy, I love saying that too, that may be available on the grid in the late evening and nighttime hours when wind tends to peak. So, you know, I think, as I mentioned this morning in a different setting, I think we're really seeing a paradigm shift where for that 135 years that Robert alluded to, the utilities have essentially seen it as their business to create the supply to respond to whatever demand is out there, right? Whatever consumers demanded, it was their job to supply it. And now I think especially with the need to increase the availability of these low-carbon energy technologies, with two of the most abundant and least expensive being solar and wind, those are great technologies, readily available across the country, relatively low cost, but they are variable. And so I think for the first time we're having to really grapple with the challenge of figuring out a way that sort of switches that paradigm around and have the demand for electricity shift to meet the available supplies, whenever those supplies come. And that's why I think the array of technologies that are represented in this room are really very promising and create the opportunity for customers to benefit themselves, right? That's one value proposition, but also to benefit the grid in a way that can really tangibly reduce the cost of operating and maintaining the grid itself, while also, you know, improving, not just sustaining, but improving the reliability and resilience of the grid.
Okay, if I was going to add one thing just from the Michigan perspective, I think the prospect of a growing electrified vehicle fleet and electrified transportation, you look at from a utility perspective of where they're going to see load growth in the next 25, 50 years, and it's projected in the U.S. at least to be flat, basically. But the one exception to that is in growing electrification of transportation. And so there's sort of the dual opportunity of seeing the one place where they can see real load growth at the same time, you know, connecting with vehicles and the vehicle to grid technologies and other things that are being brought online to better balance distributed generation, to better balance intermittent resources, and then you combine that with energy management and sort of demand management technologies that are increasingly available. And it's a different model, but it's one that is, I think, attractive to especially the utilities that are looking at places where sort of against a broad array of challenges that are separate from advanced energy, how you make their business model work in that world. And increasingly, I think advanced energy is seen as one of the opportunities as opposed to just being one of the threats.
Thank you.
This is a question about grid reliability and security focused at the local distribution utility level. As advanced technologies in the energy sector expand, are grid defenses and grid reliability technologies keeping pace? Or is there some risk that there's going to be a gap developed between what the technologies can do and perhaps the reliability or the security risks that may come along with that? Any imbalance here, or are the two moving pretty well step by step?
Tom, you want to tackle something? Jump in there?
I don't want to start, but I'm happy to weigh in.
I'll just make a comment about wind, because this is a question that's been asked of the wind industry in terms of the large penetrations that we see of wind from time to time. And the system operators that we've had examine these issues are finding it quite satisfactory that we can actually achieve very high levels of penetration. And Colorado, for instance, where I'm based, from time to time, we've seen 60% wind from time to time, albeit on average it's much lower than that, and that's managed quite effectively. We've seen levels of, in Texas, in ERCOT, we've seen 40% from time to time, albeit on average it's a lot lower.
I was thinking more about from the distribution side, where the issues could be more smart buildings that come along, as more EVs come along over 10 years plus, you start to have a very large effective variable load that could create reliability issues, some experts say, and certainly could represent cyber security issues. So my question is whether at this point you see the applications and the security defense capabilities moving step by step, or is there a gap developing?
I'd like to say one thing about that. First of all, I agree with what Richard said about the utilities being expert at running the grid. That's what they're expert at. And as the grid changes, the utilities will become expert at taking generation at the distribution level onto the grid. And, you know, being a storage behind the meter storage company, obviously our role, or we believe that our role, is to arbitrage that. You know, the wind and the solar, which are more variable resources. You know, I'm an electric company, they have 17% renewables solar on their grid, 10% of rooftop solar. And it's an island system. And so way out at the end of the line, you've got solar energy being created at a time of day when it's not being used. And it's backing up into their substations, and it is causing reliability issues today. And the solution that we're working with Hawaiian Electric on is to put batteries out at the distribution level in commercial facilities, and have those batteries available to charge at the time when that energy is coming back towards the distribution system. So I don't have a specific answer as to, you know, relax, it's going to be fine, but I do think that all of the technologies, when put together, can solve the problem and even improve security, improve reliability for the grid.
Yeah, and Peter, I just point out that I think it's been pretty well documented just how exposed a centrally organized power grid is to disruption. There have been studies that said, I don't know how many substations would have to go out in order to essentially cripple the grid.
That's the low power grid. And so you don't see as much research on the connection of advanced technologies and possible security work.
No, it's true, but by virtue of distributed energy resources carries with it some inherent benefits in terms of that sort of protection. When you look at Hurricane Sandy, the places that they kept the lights on were NYU and Princeton, which had their district energy systems combined heat and power. They kept getting natural gas, so they were able to keep their lights on while the rest of the region was in the dark. So I think
One of the values that is being looked at in distributed energy resources, for instance, in reforming the energy vision proceeding in New York, is resiliency in the face of disruption. And, you know, certainly there's potential for disruption on the cyber end as well as the severe weather end. But to the extent that you can have a distribution system that has multiple sources of energy and multiple ways of managing it, not simply in a centralized grid, that there is certainly potential there for much enhanced security rather than vulnerable.
Pete, I'll offer up one other comment. You know, the work that Karen alluded to, that STEM is doing in Hawaii, is certainly in the distribution system. Hawaii is a really interesting case in this regard, and if you're interested, there was an absolutely extraordinary document that the Hawaii Public Utilities Commission released about a year ago now, but it's still very, very timely. It's not actually still way ahead of its time. I'm happy to share that with you. It was a kind of a white paper on the commission's vision of Hawaii's energy future, and it touches on some of the issues you're talking about. So not in terms of so much cybersecurity, but in terms of system security and resilience. It talks about things like microgrids and virtual power plants, for example, and it talks about the additional grid resilience associated with the sort of prosumer approach that I described a few minutes ago. So just let me know, and I'll be happy to send that to you. It makes a really interesting reading.
David, can I ask you about this Supreme Court case coming up? I don't know many of the details of it, but just for illustrative purposes, if, say, it goes against your industry, what would that mean?
So just at the highest level, just to explain what it is, it's a question of jurisdiction over whether FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, has jurisdiction over demand response or whether it's a state jurisdictional resource because it's arguably consumers not consuming is a retail issue, and states have exclusive jurisdiction over setting retail prices. It's something that the states and the federal government are in total agreement on, so it's not states' right issues. Everybody wants it to stay where it is except for power generators who are commercially harmed by demand response. What would happen if it goes against us at the Supreme Court is a question, I think, of how demand response gets delivered in wholesale markets, not if it gets delivered. I think there's too big of a value here. You can't put the genie back in the bottle, saving billions of dollars a year. So I think it's a question of having either Congress revise the Federal Power Act, which was created in 1935, which obviously didn't contemplate demand response, and or states figuring out how to enable demand response to continue to participate in wholesale markets through their either legislative or regulatory levers, which I think is possible. So I think, you know, it could create a bumpy ride in terms of that value, but it's not going to go away. So it's going to be continued to be delivered and provide benefits one way or the other. But it is a huge issue, and it has the potential to create a lot of turmoil in wholesale markets in the near term. Richard?
If I could just add, the reason it's not going away is because PJM's independent market monitor found that demand response and energy efficiency save consumers $9 billion a year in the capacity market. So getting rid of demand response would increase power prices to consumers by $9 billion. Like that is a large number, and somebody's going to find a solution.
And I think
there may be a period of disruption, which would be very damaging.
Yeah. I mean, the question, FERC has gone out of its way saying you actually need demand response in the market to have just and reasonable rates. And so there's a question of whether you can even have wholesale markets if it's the exclusive sandbox of generation and there's no demand-side flexibility in the market.
Let's see if we have one more.
Follow-up on that question. Where does that stand right now? We see someone who's an advisor, right. Who offers their opinion to the Supreme Court? Is this forwarded to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so the original case was at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. That court decided against FERC jurisdiction of demand response. Now the Solicitor General of the United States government has petitioned to the Supreme Court to seek a petition for overriding that decision, petition for certiorari. So now it's stands at the on the desk of the Supreme Court to decide whether or not they're going to hear the case. You have the federal government with the Solicitor General on behalf of FERC. You have three states. You have industrial customers. You have environmental coalitions. You have technology companies. You have major, even generators like NRG, standing behind this resource. So hopefully the Supreme Court hears it.
Can you just explain how you work with what are the companies? Are they pledging something?
Yep.
The utility
they are pledging something, which is the curtailment of electricity to either utilities or the grid operators like PJM. So essentially they are committing to certain levels of demand reduction whenever that's needed on the system. And the way we operate it and the way the industry works is we literally install a gateway device, a piece of hardware, that allows us to stream real-time electricity consumption data and automate reductions in plants. And so it's industrial facilities shutting down production lines, it's supermarkets shutting down some lighting, it's commercial office property raising the air conditioning set points a little bit, shutting down some elevator banks, it's water distribution, wastewater plants shutting down pumping. It's literally every type of building from residential to the largest steel mill, finding flexibility in consumption and automating it, and can respond within seconds to a dispatch, just like a power plant.
And so for the production line, the cost of shutting that down?
So that would be the economic decision of what is my flexibility get me paid in the market versus what's my opportunity cost of not consuming energy, because there certainly is one, and either shifting load or not generating, not producing. So we want to find customers that have the flexibility, either inventory, or that the business case stands on its own, that it makes just economic sense for them to do this for, you know, the 1% hours a year, or roughly 88 hours a year, that drives 10 to 15% of our system's peak. So in other words, if you could get businesses to not use energy or use as much energy for 88 hours a year, you shave off 10 to 15% of the system peak, which is, again, as Richard mentioned, $9 billion per year in infrastructure costs that's avoided. So it just makes sense. And, you know, it's like an airline industry, you know, not rolling out a second plane to fly three people to San Francisco from Boston or D.C. They're going to say, who here has flexibility and will pay you for that flexibility? That's what demand response is.
And do utilities also are also doing rates that are changing so they have a lead time rate?
So the critical peak pricing rates, and I think rate design is fascinating, and solar and how this is all coming together with the utility of rate design and how do you incent this behavior and not hurt the utility. And so I think rate design is really interesting, where a lot of the innovation needs to catch up, I think, with technology.
I was just going to ask real quick, a lot of you talked about the importance of stable policy for these advanced energy technologies, and so I'm wondering, with clean power plants on the line here, what are you hearing from the entities that you work with, and how is that affecting the way that you're conducting business to try and realize what's going to be coming ahead with trying to implement this?
In a general sense, the companies that are with the advanced energy kind of asked us to be active at the federal level with the original conception and implementation of the rule. Now that the rule is in place, or almost in place to be officially sometime in June or July, we're now shifting a lot of our focus to the states. So a couple of ways. Just making available a report of 40 technologies that help greenhouse gas reduction. Taking examples, and Dan, I'll talk to you because we had a team of people both in Michigan and then shortly after that in Pennsylvania. We're sitting down with the regulators, state officials that have to implement this plan, and letting them understand all the different ways that they could actually meet that, and that this is not as heavy a lift as has been made out to be presented by some of the incumbent interests. And so I think the most important thing is to bring the knowledge that companies around this table have and the ability to help set that state plan in motion, implementation plan, in a way that includes energy efficiency, includes renewables, includes ways in which we can make that outcome be one that is good for the economy, it's good for energy and energy costs, and it also helps provide a cleaner environment as we see the implementation of that plan be executed. Dan, you were involved in those meetings in Michigan. Maybe that could be helpful.
And so, and it's exactly as Graham said. So one of the things that we saw very clearly is that in Michigan and in a lot of other states, the people who are charged with developing the compliance mechanisms are our state air office. State air offices have, you know, since the Clean Air Act, 40 years of experience of developing sort of compliance measures that look like scrubbers on stacks. They do not look like what are the other technology alternatives that exist. And so bringing 40 ideas, so you can use these in, and they're often more cost effective, but that education process, also connecting the state air offices with the state public service commissions, they're talking, but being a place that we can facilitate that conversation to make sure that the folks looking out for the energy regulatory issues are in constant communication with the people who are developing what our state compliance plan looks like. And then connecting them at our meeting, we had actually Enernoc and Oak Power both at the table, as well as a number of Michigan-based companies. We had the Public Service Commission, we had the Department of Environmental Quality, which is our state air office. We also had regional chambers of commerce, because they were saying, hey, a strong national rule boosts solar manufacturing in Michigan. A strong state compliance measure means that we've got better markets for energy efficiency contractors that are delivering savings to our manufacturers, as well as residential homeowners and small businesses and everything else. So that sort of convening and putting everybody around the same table is one piece. The second thing I'd mention is that we really are increasingly seeing, I think, the Clean Power Plan not just a way of addressing the issues at the heart of it, which are carbon issues and that sort of thing, but also distribution reliability. Michigan had the highest number of outages over the last 10 years. Our distribution grid is not healthy, and to be able to integrate these technologies from on-site generation to combined heat and power to battery storage, backup, vehicle to grid, all of those provide opportunities to not just develop a cleaner grid, but a better one, and often a more cost-effective one when you're looking at the trade-offs between what we could do with advanced energy and what we'd do if we just used the same approach that we've used over the last 40 years. So I think it's both sort of making sure that the conversation happens and making sure that people are educated about the alternatives, but also saying this: let's just not narrow the conversation to what we have to do, but how do we leverage this opportunity to do all the other things that are possible because of it?
Natural gas is part of the vision very much. I think in the report on turbines, so this is not just grid edge type technology, but
yes, we've included natural gas turbines and equipment as part of our conception of advanced energy, because it is cleanest and domestic resource. It's and a very valuable resource. Also, it's an alternative to petroleum in transportation, so we track natural gas vehicles, both LNG and CNG vehicles, as in addition to electric vehicles, as part of the evolving energy technology.
But not the extraction side.
We don't deal with the extraction side. We're really looking at the application rather than the source.
If I can add to that, I think, you know, it's worth noting there's an awful lot of innovation, actually, in gas turbine technology and turbine design, too. I mean, and a lot of it is in response to the broadly understood need to embrace more of the lower zero carbon technology. So if you look at, you know, GE, for example, you know, virtually all of the new work that they're doing in turbine technology is designed for a flexible operation and fast ramping and operating at higher efficiency with lower emission partial load. So all that is oriented toward, not 100%, but a lot of the driver for that is the recognition that their technology plays an important role in helping to sort of firm and shape the availability, around the availability of solar and wind and other variable resources.
Yeah, let's go to the line and see if there are any questions from our callers on the phone.
At this time, there are no questions from the phones.
That's all that. Anything else in the room?
Everyone, sure. I'm interested to hear a little bit holy grail. But where the applications are making sense today, SunPower, I believe you recently partnered with Sunbird, right? So could you talk a little more about the solar storage relationship that we're seeing a lot more of now?
Sure. Yeah, as you noted, we announced that we're working closely with a company called Sunverge to provide smart power in a box, basically, technology. We've deployed it in some pilot programs around the world, actually, in the U.S. I'll come back to that. Also in Australia and in Germany. In the U.S., pilot programs have been principally with KV Homes, which is one of the nation's leading home builders, and we've done two programs with them. They're already an established SunPower customer on the solar power side, deploying solar in virtually all of their new homes. But we've partnered with them, one subdivision in Southern California and one in Eastern California outside of Sacramento, to integrate the Sunverge technology along with SunPower's PV technology in all of the homes in some new subdivisions.
How does this complement the existing grid as opposed to create a disruptive factor? Because that's where it's creating the opportunity to go off grid potentially. So how can you integrate it in a way that works with existing business models?
That's a great question, and certainly, you know, these technologies do over time create the opportunity for customers to be more independent from the grid, to operate independently from the grid. These systems do provide essentially an uninterruptible power supply for the home. So in the event of an outage, your lights don't even flicker. They just transfer more or less instantaneously to the combination of the PV and battery backup, and the customers don't even really know necessarily if there's an outage. But we don't see that as the principal value. We see the principal value, the one that we've described already in this room, which is the benefits to the customer of essentially being able to use these technologies to better manage their own energy consumption and production to minimize their overall energy bill. And that's one value proposition. But the other value proposition is the value of using that same equipment to benefit the grid itself. So, you know, Ben, I'm sure you have the CalISO's work around the duck chart, and you know that, you know, basically the issue there, I'm oversimplifying, because to make the point is, you know, we're going to have, I love saying, too much solar energy on the grid during the middle of the day, and we need more energy on the grid in the early evening hours. So, you know, at one level, the response is pretty simple, right? Use the available the combination of the PV, which is generating electricity, but instead of delivering it back into the grid in the middle of the day when there's already a surplus of that energy, you can store that in your battery bank and then deliver when presumably the cost of energy is low, or to put it differently, you're not going to get paid a lot for it if you deliver it back to the grid during the middle of the day because there's already too much. On the other hand, if you store that in your battery and deliver it back to the grid later that evening, during the peak period, and you presumably can get a higher price for it because the utility is going to value it being delivered back on the grid at that time. So that's a very simple example, but there's many more complex examples, but that's a very simple illustration of how you can create a good value proposition in that respect. It's also worth noting, given the example I just gave, that we and other companies have already done a lot of work and continue to work on the technology side of this, but we also need a lot of innovation in the regulatory frameworks that enable this to happen. And so that's, you know, we in our industry are doing a fair amount of work in that space, but we need to figure, I think it was you that mentioned the need for, to pay more attention to rate design and to program design that really encourage and enable the sorts of benefits to be captured.
I'll just add three things. First, CalISO. We're doing a pilot with them for a head bid into the CalISO. So similar to what Tom mentioned about the duck chart, we can store energy in the batteries and then bid in a day ahead and have that available within seconds of call. And then the second thing is the off-grid and the microgrid idea. Most customers, even large commercial customers, no, barring a few exceptions, do not want to run their own grid. Most of them want a reliable grid. When they flip the light switch, the lights come on, and they don't have to think about it. I wonder if my battery was 10 years old and I should have changed it. They want a grid. And so all of our solutions are designed to get into and plug into that grid. And then finally, what Tom was saying, this is a really complicated question that you're asking about solar or wind and storage at the same facility. because it seemed like a match made in heaven, peanut butter and jelly. But because of the incentives and the regulatory framework and these things that we're up against, actually storage is great on the grid, but it may not be great in combination with a solar system at that site, depending on the rate structure and depending on the regulatory environment. So we love renewable energy and we also love the grid. And if it's perfect to put them together in one facility, we do that. And if it's perfect to go to the grid and supply the storage there, then we do that. Until, enlightenment, when we have all of the regulatory policies aligned.
I guess who owns the storage makes a big difference, whether it's on utility side or customers and how they aggregate it. Like,
mm-hmm.
Does that provide utility and?
No, just the customer side of the meter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. I want to see if Grant has any final words here. We're on schedule. I want to let people go. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you to each of you for being with us, our members of our companies and our representatives in the media. We look forward to continuing to share more good news as we work on the policies that will help sort of transform the advanced energy economic impact and opportunity. We're, I think, just beginning to see this sort of coming together of a number of different drivers. We didn't talk today about innovative new finance, but we see that happening. Dan Scripps has been working with us to look at some innovation there. Technologies continue to develop, as we all know and see, that can be quite disruptive and also complementary. The other thing that I would mention, just as we're closing, in the 3 years that we've been working to build this organization, I have seen both a higher degree of collaboration and trust, while there's also competition and opposition, among the CEOs of the electric utility industry. And we've also seen a generational change in that leadership. And we're seeing companies, I recall very vividly as a closing anecdote at our gathering in Boston, your partner, Tim Healy, looked across at the CEO of Northeast Utilities, who was talking about the regulatory constraints, saying, my demand is going down, and I'm having a challenge trying to figure out how to satisfy ratepayers, how to satisfy the shareholders of my company, and also move to the decisions the public's making about wanting more clean energy. And Tim Edelman said, that's the kind of challenge that advanced energy companies want to work with you to solve. And while we have a lot of rhetoric about this, underlying this, I see a different attitude than what I saw 3 years ago. There's a desire to get it right, to make it work. This is a highly investment capital intensive industry. We're told that our 198 public utility commissioners around the country have an impact on $100 billion of estimated capital expenditures between now and 2020. That's a lot of capital, probably one of the most significant focused capital investment circumstances. And I think, so I would just share that I really am an optimist at heart, but I also think I'm a realist, and we're seeing that shift. We're seeing a mental model change. Tom, you're CEO for North America's. Howard was with us. Karen was also there at a gathering where we had representatives of the three electric utilities in California just 2 weeks ago. And we had an opportunity to discuss common principles, ideas that we could share between the electric utilities and advanced energy companies, and then take to the California Public Utility Commission as we begin to rethink. And out of that came the discussion, well, these are the things we all have to work on, rate design. We have to figure out how CAISO can continue to be able to have the structure and the regulatory opportunity for managing and integrating all of these new demands on the system. But the fact that these conversations are deep, there's a bit higher degree of trust, and that we are beginning to get action, Rev probably being the most prominent example of that in New York. This is actual translation of that discussion into a new regulatory model. Lot to be done. We've learned a lot from our friends in Europe, and I think we're going to try to build that system that we yet have not all the details, but it's going to be one that will, I believe, be secure and clean and affordable. So thank you very much. Do you have another question?